good afternoon and welcome to the Jason Rancho on AM 770 KTTH, streaming on the KTTH smartphone app. Are the Democrats in charge in Seattle finally willing to admit a mistake? Oh, they actually seem pretty close to doing just that. That is what's trending.
What's trending in Seattle?
We've been covering all the drama associated with this minimum wage hike, specifically for the rideshare drivers who deliver food. You'll recall, of course, at the state level, there is a mandatory minimum wage for the drivers, and it prevented cities from getting involved for Uber, Lyft, all the other ones, just from a driver perspective. But of course, they were still able to find this loophole to address the people who work for Uber Eats, DoorDash, Grubhub, those kinds of things. You go on your phone, you fire up your app, you order your food, and then bam, somewhere between 45 minutes and an hour and 37 minutes later, you will get your food cold, not properly packaged, and not left at the right spot that you told them to leave it. Not that I know from experience. But with this new, and it was passed, let's be clear, by the last Seattle City Council, not the current one. But with this new legislation, they ended up getting paid about like $26 and change per hour, which is yay, we love that. Except the drivers weren't getting any orders because it became way too expensive to operate in Seattle. And they decided to raise your fees by $5 per order across the board. And it just became too unaffordable to order. I keep doing this example, but it just blows my mind. This morning, I was trying to prove my point to someone on the East Coast who had not heard of this story. And I said, okay, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to order us two lattes, grandes, and just normal ones. No, you know, you're not worthy of extra cost for, you know, sugar-free vanilla. And two oatmeals. That's it. It costs $40. Or it was like $41 and change. And just $16 of that came from fees and service fees and taxes and all this other stuff. That's just too much. No one would ever pay for that. And so for a lot of folks who work in this industry who thought they were going to get a whole bunch of money that they didn't earn nor deserve, no offense. I know what you do is hard, but not $26 an hour hard. They now find themselves not making anything. Some of them aren't getting any jobs in an hour, and they just say, okay, never mind, I'm going to turn offline. Now, the Seattle City Council just started the perhaps partial rollback of the minimum wage hike, or at least the guarantee part of this. It's only been in effect for 2 months, and they've already heard from people noting not only is this harming the drivers, but it's harming the restaurants because no one's going to buy from a restaurant if you're getting hit with like a 40% increase on the total of your food to the fee. It's just not feasible. And so the Seattle Times says that the Seattle City Council could begin discussing the rollback within just the next few weeks. They say some council members have raised the idea of striking down the law entirely, but the more likely scenario is a reduction in what the companies are required to pay for drivers. Representatives from DoorDash and Instacart have spent the last week negotiating with Sarah Nelson, the Seattle City Council president, who's also very pro-business, business-friendly. She's a business owner. She understands. And also a part of the conversation is the group called Drive Forward, which is, it's basically a bunch of union activists who are pretending that they're working on behalf of these drivers when really all they're doing is trying to weaken Uber and the others. Now, we don't know what specifically this is all going to look like. We don't know what the fee structure will look like. And we expect to get this within the next few weeks. But the Seattle Times says early drafts of Drive Forward's proposal show a roughly 11% reduction in the minimum hourly wage for drivers and a 40% reduction per mile reimbursement. That doesn't seem like it's going to be nearly enough to make a difference here. That's not going to be enough. We're all at the end of this. Even if they bring this down, we're still going to be paying something. And if it's an extra $2, maybe people will do it. Maybe. An extra $5 as it is now is definitely obviously a no. Now, beyond that, they say the proposal does not include any requirement the companies scale back their service charges. which means even if they wanted to, they can continue to put that in place, that $5. And by the way, who are you to say they can't charge a fee for services if that's what they choose to do? This whole, we're going to stop them from doing. No, they get to do what they want there. In fact, they could right now, they can make it $10 if they want. It'd probably be no different for most people than the $5. It's silly, but they're doing what they can to stay operational. They say the most significant structural change would be moving away from the setting of minimums for every trip and toward weekly minimums, meaning the companies would top up the driver pay at the end of the week if it was less than the minimum wage. If drivers earned more, they would keep that pay. This change, said Michael Wolf, the executive director of Drive Forward, puts more pricing power in the hands of companies. Now, a spokesperson for DoorDash said their preference remains a full appeal. Repeal, not appeal. They're appealing for a repeal. But the Seattle Times continues, acknowledged that was unlikely and said the company is still engaged in negotiations with the council. Without promising a full rollback of the service charges put into place after the law took effect, the spokesperson said the company would adjust in kind with whatever rates come of this new law. They say our message to the council is the same as the message we're overwhelmingly hearing from Dashers, businesses, and consumers in Seattle. It's time to fix this broken law. Now, Sarah Nelson hasn't commented, which is normal. I don't expect her to. But it at least sounds like there's going to be something. Will it be enough? Don't know. No clue if it's going to be enough. But I do know that if they don't do something, you're going to see these companies just say, yeah, we're probably just going to get out completely of this business. Because I have to imagine that from like Uber's perspective, for example, they've got Uber for cars, just for driving, and then they've got the Uber Eats for the delivery. Now, the only reason why Uber is probably still even in this market is that the Uber drivers who are not delivering food, that's at least still a semi-workable model. It's becoming less and less of a workable model because of how expensive it is. I mean, just to take an Uber drive or a Lyft drive or it is insanely expensive. And even people who have the money, look, I have the money to spend on this if I want to, but I sometimes look at the price. I'm like, I will not pay that. I'm just not going to do that. I'm out. I'm not going to spend, $20 for a drive that's only a mile that will take you 8 minutes. I'm not going to spend $20 on that. And for people who have to go to the airport, upwards of like $50, $60, even sometimes $70, depending on the time of day. Like, no, I'm not doing that from Seattle to there. So I take light rail. I take light rail there. I take light rail back. I hate it. It's disturbing to be on light rail given how unsafe it is. And for any of you who follow me on Twitter, you saw the video I posted today. You know exactly what it is I'm talking about. But I do that because I'm just not going to spend the $60. I cannot justify that. I refuse to justify that. But I would argue that if that wasn't part of this, if this was, let's just say this was the legislation that was hitting Uber and Lyft as well, not just for food delivery, because Lyft doesn't do food delivery, but just drivers in general, they would just pull out like they did in Minneapolis. Minneapolis, and we covered this a couple weeks ago, they basically passed the same kind of law. The numbers are a little bit different, but basically the same scenario where they made it just too expensive for Uber and Lyft to operate. It wasn't worth it for them. Because now, under this law that they passed in Minneapolis, app drivers make $15.57 an hour. That's the city's minimum wage. And on top of that, $1.40 per mile and 51 cents per minute. Now, if you're stuck in traffic, that's going to be a whole lot of money for you as a driver, right? You go a long way and you get stuck in traffic. It doesn't really make financial sense for Uber and Lyft. So they said, okay, we're out. We're pulling out on, I think it was May 1st. May 1st, we are pulling out. Uber and Lyft were no longer going to be serving anyone here in Minneapolis. And, you had some council members come up and say, whoa, I don't believe them. They're not going to do it. How dare they? Well, things are starting to change a little bit in that world. Because on the one hand, you've got the Democrat governor, Tim Walz, pushing for a compromise to try to keep the apps from leaving Minneapolis. You've got members of the legislature in Minnesota who are on the right pushing for a completely separate bill that fixes this issue completely, gets rid of it. You will then have some pushback, I imagine, from like a handful of the activists who don't think that this is serious, that this is all just a lie coming from Uber. But as I said a couple weeks ago, like, they would be in a really bad spot if they bluffed this. If they bluff this, they're basically giving all of their, you know, all their chips away early on in negotiations in other cities that are thinking about or currently trying to do something like this. But now we've got a council member, Andrea Jenkins. She voted to approve the ordinance, but she told the council she's going to move for the reconsideration of the ordinance out of this council on April 11th. She's now having second thoughts. Now, I don't know if she's doing this because she has votes. I don't know if she's doing this because she wants to just force the issue, because maybe, you know, she's feeling that this is going to backfire. Maybe others will. And let's just put it on the table and see where we all stand. I don't know. But this is obviously a step in the right direction. But they're going to be pushing this to the wire. You know, Uber and Lyft gave them until May 1st. And so all Uber and Lyft has to do is just flip the switch and they can just continue to stay on board. But I don't know if it's going to get done by then. It's obviously possible that it can. And my guess is what you're going to get in Minneapolis is what you got maybe happening here in Seattle, which is a quote-unquote compromise. But again, they are putting these people out of business. They are, in the name of helping keep the working people employed with a living wage, they are putting them out of work. And they're doing it over and over and over again, and no one on the union side of things wants to say anything, and you've got workers who are foolish enough to believe that they have their best interests in mind when the union has its own interests in mind. They are too in bed with left-wing politicians. They have too much power, too much money off of your backs, and you're generally not getting anything for it. Sometimes there is a clear need for unions. I'm not anti-union in a traditional sense, like across the board. I'm very clearly not anti-union. I support law enforcement unions all the time on the show. But the problem is, because they're so driven by their political ideology, their activism, they end up not seeing the forest for the trees. They end up having blinders on to the reality of what it is they're doing. And the whole $15 minimum wage fiasco in Seattle, I mean, look to where it exploded. It's now over $20. And at $15 an hour, people were losing their jobs. People were losing hours. They were seeing some jobs being put into one, not just two consolidated, but sometimes even three, depending on the industry. And it hurts the small businesses the most. And they don't seem to care because this is just about going after big business. But they don't understand, these folks, how big business works. Again, Uber's not going to stay in a market that is upside down, and they're not going to borrow their profits from a great location to try to bolster one that's a loser. Why would they do that? That does not make any sense. It does not make any sense unless there's some really specific reason why these companies have to be in that one particular market. And you could argue that maybe, like, let's say the market was DC, where you got a lot of lawmakers. Well, you want a lawmaker to understand the value of Uber and Lyft. So even if you were not making any money in DC market, well, you can then borrow from LA or Seattle or Portland or wherever it is that you are making a little bit more money. You can put it there to you know, justify staying in that dead market, because at the long term, this might help you. They obviously don't see that in Minneapolis. They obviously don't see it there. So they better figure this out there, because there's going to be a lot of people come May 1st without a job. And I don't think they're bluffing here. Doesn't make sense for them to bluff in this case. Let's find out what else is trending.
What's trending? Well, that's ironic.
Some more bad news for Boeing. Not only do they expect to see some significant financial losses, which at least we all saw coming, but now the passengers who were on the original plane that caused all of this, the one from Portland where the fuselage door was all like, hey, peace out, I don't want to be attached to you no more, and decided to just leave. Well, now those people are being told by the FBI that they might be victims of a crime. Literally of a crime. Mark Lindquist got a letter from the FBI. Mark Lindquist is an attorney representing a number of the people who were on board. He hit the mother load there with clients because this is going to be a huge settlement. But he says that they got a letter from the FBI office in Seattle. And the letter says, in part, "I'm contacting you because we have identified you as a possible victim of a crime." So, okay, that's not good. Lindquist told CNN, "My clients and I welcome the DOJ investigation. We want accountability. We want answers. We want safer Boeing planes, and a DOJ investigation helps advance our goals." Now, they don't say specifically what the crime was and who was responsible, but obviously we know that if this was done as a result of, you know, not just mismanagement, but a just skirting the duty to make sure that they are following safety protocols, that they are not, in fact, just shipping out products before they've even been checked or properly checked. And I'm assuming this is Boeing and it's not Alaska Airlines in a criminal investigation, but I don't know. I can tell you that it's not been a very good month for Boeing. I can tell you that they are struggling, and it's not, I shouldn't even say month. It's been the last few months haven't been good. And we're getting to the point of no return for them, at least from a airline perspective. I get that they do more than just airlines, but again, there are significant implications if people stop wanting to fly as passengers on Boeing, because the airlines are going to force that. Now, a Boeing executive, the CFO, Brian West, he said this week that we should expect a rather significant cash burn once the first quarter numbers come out. And specifically, it's because of the 737 MAX program. As he pointed out while talking at an economic forum this week, it was in London, he said, we've got to slow down the production of the 737.
We're the ones who made the decision to constrain rates on the 737 program below 38 per month until we feel like we're ready.
Yeah, well, congratulations. I mean, you were kind of forced into that position, though, right? So, you know, you can spare me the whole, well, we made the decision. Well, did you, though? You didn't really make the, I mean, you technically made the decision, but did you really? Kind of had to make that decision. Right now, the quality control mechanisms over at Boeing under a lot of scrutiny. Rightly so, they should be. When a door plug blows out on one of your planes at 17,000 feet in the air, yeah, people are going to scrutinize you. And again, we've said this, everyone said this, they got lucky that it happened at 17,000 feet instead of 30,000 feet, because that would be a completely different ballgame here. We'd be dealing with a lot of dead bodies. Now, of course, the panel was missing four bolts that were necessary to keep it in place. So that obviously didn't make things any easier on poor Alaska Airlines, who I think, again, based on the news, I don't see any reason to blame them. It seems like Boeing was at fault here. But the whistleblower, two whistleblowers now, one for this particular program, but one in another general sense, he's the one who killed himself, pretty much are saying, look, they suffer at Boeing as being a company that puts, just from a cultural perspective, puts profit over quality. And it was something that Brian West, the CFO, kind of admitted.
For years, we prioritized the movement of the airplane through the factory over getting it done right. And that's got to change.
Has it changed yet, or does it got to change? You just haven't gotten there yet? Can you clarify? And by the way, you say you've been doing this for years, this cultural shift. How many of those planes are in circulation right now, the ones that for the last several years you've been not doing things the right way? Right? And I can't help but wonder, what's the next fuselage panel door issue, right? Like, not specifically with the panel door, but what's the next fuselage door? What's the next big issue that happens on a Boeing plane? What else did they not properly consider the safety of before they were just pushing it out for consumers to use, for airlines to take? What is that next issue? Because obviously no one saw the fuselage panel door issue coming. So what's the next one that no one sees coming? In the back of my mind, I legitimately have that fear with Boeing. And because of that cultural issue that they just mentioned, they brought this all on themselves. I don't want Boeing to do poorly. I obviously want them to do well and to thrive. We have a lot economically on the line here. But they brought this on themselves. And I don't think they've done a very good job in navigating around this. There's no doubt that it's difficult to navigate something like this. But what you don't want to have happen during a time where people don't trust you as much as you'd like when it comes to safety, you don't want the head of the NTSB to come out and say, oh yeah, they've been withholding names for people that we need to have conversations with, interview as part of our investigation. They just didn't handle that well. That should have never been the case. That should have never gotten out. They should have given everything that they needed to, handed over to the feds, and then make sure that you address any like reasonable concerns. At the same time, you've got Boeing also trying to compete in the marketplace. Airbus ended up this week just securing two very major orders from the flagship carriers of Japan and South Korea, according to Bloomberg. Now, Airbus is not an American company. That's a European-based company. They say Japan Airlines is buying, 21 Airbus 350-900s and 11 A321neos. I don't like the Neos. And that is what Bloomberg calls a significant step in, quote, breaking Boeing's exclusive hold as the sole single-aisle jet supplier for the carrier. Now, 2 hours after that news was announced, Korean Airlines announced that they were purchasing 33 Airbus A350s. And that meant Boeing wasn't able to get anything there. In the Japan Airlines, they were still able to get a small deal. They were able to get a deal for 10 787 wide bodies. But the Korean Airlines purchase was exclusive of Airbus. So let's just say they go ahead, and I'm assuming, for the sake of the argument, that Airbus delivers on time, on budget, everything is perfect, no safety issues whatsoever. Well, Japan Airlines and Korean Airlines, the next time they have to order jets, they're going to look at Airbus again, and they're going to see Airbus, you know, previously delivering everything they needed to without any controversies around safety, we hope. And they're going to say, okay, well, why would we risk it with Boeing when we've got something that's working right now with Airbus? So we don't know where this is all headed. But I can tell you this, for Boeing, it's not headed in the right direction, and they better get their talking points and their messaging and their, you know, culture in line. 1-800-465-8770 if you want to send me a text message. When we come back, we're going to do an interview that's a little bit different than what I normally do. There is a move to completely rewrite a legislative district in Washington State. And unfortunately, a judge was the one who in Seattle decided to rewrite one particular district that ended up impacting a whole bunch of different districts. And now a lot of Republican positions in the state legislature on the line. Now it's being appealed, but it's on the line. One of the groups behind this push on the left-wing side is going to join us in a bit. And I'm not going to yell. I'm not going to get all snippy. I just want to know some basic answers to questions that I think they owe us all. We're going to get to that when we come back on the Jason Brand Show.
The Jason Rand Show.
Here to react, Seattle talk radio host Jason Rand.
And the rise of soft on crime laws and policies have made it worse.
Our man in the Pacific Northwest, Jason Rand, is on that.
And you keep on bringing us these extraordinary stories from Seattle. It's amazing.
Long form.
A U.S. District Court judge in Seattle tossed a legislative map in order to create a majority Latino voting district in the general Yakima area. It impacts 13 legislative districts in total. On top of it, it switches one of the districts from the 15th to the 14th in order to ensure that the state Senate elections fall on a presidential year when Latino voter turnout is generally higher than in the other elections. Proponents argue that this is necessary to better represent the interests of the Latino community in this particular area of Washington state. Of course, the Latino population is quite high. Joining me on the line to discuss is Sunny Wachneen. She's the program manager and voting rights counsel for the UCLA Voting Rights Project, which helped move this case along. Sunny, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So if you can start by just telling us, big picture, why was this new map necessary? It came as a result of redistricting. We do this every 4 years. The specific map that was drawn was not deemed competent enough or good enough for the community.
Well, sure. Let me kind of set the stage, right? After every census, it's called usually the decennial census, every state, every municipality, every place in the country that is districted actually has to redraw their districts to ensure that there's total equalization of total populations, just meaning that, you know, every district is as equal as possible mm-hmm. in total pop, and to ensure that there's compliance with federal law and with state law. In Washington, the redistricting for the state legislative districts happened in about November of 2021, and Latino voters in the Yakima Valley that I'm lucky enough to represent found the map. They advocated for a map that kept their communities and respected their community of interest. And instead, the map that was enacted cracked the Latino community of interest in the Yakima Valley, and also had the effect of diluting Latino voters' ability to elect candidates of their choice, which is a little bit of a term of art under the Federal Voting Rights Act. But in August, after a week-long trial, a federal judge found that the effect of the 2021 enacted map, state legislative map, had the effect of racial discrimination or a vote dilution for Latino voters, and found it necessary to redraw a new map to remedy or fix that vote dilution problem. So I hope I give you a helpful
you did.
Context and overview.
You absolutely did. You said something that caught my attention about under the previous map. And by the way, this is going to be appealed, so we don't know if this is actually going to be the final map, but we'll approach this as if that is going to be the case. Why wouldn't they be able to vote for someone of their choosing based on the old map? That, I don't understand that point.
Sure. So under the enacted or the older map, what we knew was that that there was this thing called polarized voting within the region. So it's a little complicated, but basically what we understand is that Latino voters were first not connected with other with their community of interest, with other folks. So the enacted map left out the areas of Wapato and Toppenish, which we know form a community of interest in the lower Yakima Valley. That was like the first issue. But the second issue is about whether or not Latino voters are able to elect candidates of choice, which is a requirement under the Federal Voting Rights Act. And so,
well, what's a candidate of choice? Sorry, I guess that's the part that's throwing me.
Sure. So what we know is that there are someone who the community coalesces or votes cohesively for. So we have all these experts, and some of them actually come from Washington State, from the University of Washington. There's a lot that come from UW. And it is these political scientists understand voting patterns. They look at election results and census data and precinct results and are able to say, well, you know, Latino voters in this context vote cohesively behind candidate X, Y, and Z. And non-Latino voters or white voters who are the majority in the area, they vote for these other candidates. So they vote in opposite directions. But what that means in a district is that if you're drawing a district in a manner where, you know, Latinos who can form a majority to be able to elect candidates of choice are unable to because of the way that the district line's drawn, that may run afoul under the Federal Voting Rights Act. And so that was what was found by this federal judge after, again, an extensive trial with tons of expert and witness testimony. That's what this judge found, that the way that the district lines were drawn did not allow Latinos to vote, to coalesce around a single candidate of their choosing.
What is the bar, if you know it off the top of your head, of when we say coalesce, what is that percentage? 60-40? Is it 70-30? Like, what is that? I'm curious.
So actually, that's a really interesting question. It's based off of a local appraisal, right? So the Supreme Court and the law don't say if you reach this number, there's like a bright line rule. And that's because everywhere in the country is different. This is a law, the Federal Voting Rights Act, that applies literally everywhere, right? In the country, it applies to municipalities and to the state, whole states. And so it's the courts, after doing a local appraisal, kind of are able to determine, you know, whether or not voters are cohesive. So there's just no bright line rule for you.
So is the basic argument that, because I've heard this certainly before, that a lawmaker, it's important for a lawmaker to look like the majority of the district and share, you know, similar traits, including cultural values, principles, things like that. Is that the basic argument?
Well, so actually, it really goes down, and this is a little bit of a history lesson. What the issue for Congress was when passing the Federal Voting Rights Act was responsive representation. So are your elected officials responsive to you? Meaning that, are you able to contact someone in your community that you were able to vote for or felt like they had to earn your vote, right? And so a lot of the issue is not so much about what folks look like or the race of a candidate. We're actually not really concerned with, when I say we, I mean the rural we are not really concerned with the race of a candidate, but instead, or an elected official, but instead how responsive that person is to the community. And so that is, as we know, right, representation matters. Why does it matter? Because of services. So I hope that answers your question.
Well, it kind of does. I guess I would ask then, what evidence is there that there wasn't a responsiveness from an individual? I mean, obviously, you know, in this case, what ended up happening, if we stick with this map, is that it basically boots from office the first Eastern Washington Latina elected to the office of the Senate. So, I mean, was there any suggestion that she was not being responsive to the needs of the district?
Sure. So the district court actually found that there was a generalized lack of responsiveness and really a lack of responsiveness for quite a while from the elected officials that were in Eastern Washington towards the Latino community. And her testimony with during the trial about the lack of responsiveness. So I think that is what the court had heard and understood in terms of showing that there was vote dilution happening.
But yeah, vote dilution is different though, right? I mean, when we're talking about vote dilution, there's a general assumption, I think it sounds like what you're saying, and correct me if I'm wrong, that Latino voters or maybe any group of voters that have a shared, you know, ethnic background or any background that's similar will generally vote the same way, generally speaking, not 100%, obviously.
Well, so that's something that has to be proven, right?
Yeah.
So,
well, I guess that's what I'm asking.
Yeah. You have to prove that there are voters that are, like in this case, Latino voters who are voting cohesively behind candidates. So that is something that you have to show. Yes, that's part of a vote dilution, So, but here, when we talk about responsiveness, you know, the court found, the federal district court found that there was a lack of responsiveness. That's another thing that the court considers when demonstrating that there was a Section 2 violation.
Sure.
And when I say Section 2, I mean a Federal Voting Rights Act violation.
Is it then, would it be fair to say that if more Latino voters supported the current senator in that district, that at least half of that test might not have been met to warrant a redistricting?
Well, the case was, and it was demonstrated at trial, actually, that Latino voters did not, in that region, did not support.
I know. I'm saying if that was not the case, if they did, in fact, vote for her, that would make this entire thing moot because they coalesced, the Latino votes coalesced around one particular candidate?
Well, I just can't get into hypotheticals. We're dealing with, the reality, which is that Latino voters didn't elect a candidate of choice in either LB14 or LB15.
Under the new map, do you know generally what the breakdown is then of Latino voters in the district? Because obviously it the way that it was redrawn, it impacts 13 total districts. I will note 12 of those districts are Republican districts and only one was Democrat. But what's now the total general population of Latino voters in the district?
Are you asking
like percentage wise?
Can you clarify your question? Are you asking the total population?
I'm asking, what is the percentage of Latino voters now in the district? So before it was, and I'm making this number up just for the sake of argument, of 40%, and now it's 70% or 50%. Like, do you know what that breakdown is?
The Hispanic voting age population is 51%, a little over that.
Okay, so about 51% now Latino votes. That obviously means 49% are non-Latino, and that I imagine still probably majority of the 49% are white. Then you get Black, Asian, and Native American in some variety of different numbers, percentages. What would be the argument against a Native American community saying, well, now we definitely don't get to have the person that we want in positions of power because we, even if we were all to coalesce around an individual candidate, the Latino community has way more representation now.
And so I...
Because doesn't this just open up another problem when there's not... Yeah, I mean, the whole idea is that there's a large Latino community. They were not able to vote the way they wanted to, or at least they didn't have enough power to put the person in a position of power that they wanted, that they would have gone for a different candidate. And obviously the numbers suggest that. But couldn't the same exact thing be said about any other community, including the white community? Right? I mean, white voters can say, well, now we can't connect and get someone that we want. It just sounds racist when it says that way. But I mean, that it's the same argument.
Well, you know, there's a few things. You have to demonstrate, right, that the electoral opportunity is, as we did in this case, or as shown in this case, has a dilutive effect, right?
Sure.
On voters that and to cover under the Federal Voting Rights Act. And then you have to prove all of the elements of a Federal Voting Rights Act claim, right? And so, you know,
Wouldn't the white vote be diluted?
In this case, are you saying that
in this particular instance, I don't know what it was before, but again, obviously it was, if you're adding, because you're changing the districts and you're adding more Latino, you know, voters.
As the court found that the remedial map provides all voters within the Yakima Valley an ability to elect their candidates of choice, including white voters.
So if the senator or both senators are, you know, again, let's just say that there wasn't a consistent vote from the Latino community, let's say that it was they were split. And I imagine that that's, you know, obviously a possibility. What does that mean as far as the map is concerned? Because the thinking here is obviously you've got a larger Latino community. They're going to coalesce behind a candidate. So I'm saying, that's obviously an assumption. It might be a fair assumption. It might end up being the truth. But let's just say it wasn't. Let's just say of the 51%, you had 30% going for one candidate, the rest going for another one. And that happened to also be where the Native American voters went or the white voters went. Does that indicate that the map needs to be redrawn again? Or is that at that point, yeah, that's just how politics runs. You can never guarantee you're going to get a perfect candidate for any one group.
Well, Jason, I know that you're providing me a lot of hypotheticals here, and instead I want to go back to the fact of what the federal court found, which is they found a violation of the Federal Voting Rights Act in the Yakima Valley, and they implemented a map that would allow all voters to elect candidates of choice.
So is it fair to say...
We could throw hypotheticals out all day.
Well, yeah, I mean, I only ask it because I think it's an important one, only in the sense that if there's still a dilution of voting... would you then sue again to redraw the map? That's where my question is coming from, because no one ever knows who's going to get support. We make assumptions, and like I said, you can look at the history and make valid assumptions, but assumptions don't always hold true. So my question is, are you satisfied with this map as is, or does your satisfaction come with the result of the next election, meaning will enough Latino voters coalesce behind a candidate?
Well, the inquiry here was whether or not this map would be a remedial map. And so as the court found with the assistance of the special master, that this map is a remedial map. Now we will see what happens in the 2024 election, but the Voting Rights Act guarantees an equal opportunity for folks to elect their candidates of choice. So this map, as the court found, does that.
Okay. We will see where things go. Like I said, there's going to be an appeal if it hasn't already been filed. We've been talking with Sunny Walkneen. She's the program manager and voting rights counsel for the UCLA Voting Rights Project. Thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, of course.
You're listening to The Jason Rand Show. When we come back, we're going to dive into some quick hits.
The Jason Rand Show.
Let's bring in our man in the Pacific Northwest, KTTH, Seattle Talk Radio host Jason Rantz. Great to have you with us to tell people a little bit more about this.
Jason Rantz is in focus now.
Jason Rantz, thank you for your reporting on that.
The quick hit.
I guess Stormy Daniels is back. I think she's got a book out. My interest in her does not extend to even Googling whether or not she has a book out. That's my assumption because she was on The View this week. And the only reason why I want to bring this up is because I saw more people talking about a comment that she made and a comparison that she made. And she was telling the ladies of The View that she was upset that she was being harassed or bullied by Trump supporters. And I thought it an odd statement to make in the context of what the left has done to Trump supporters and to Trump administration officials. But here's the weird comparison she made.
I said in some interview or somewhere, I believe, that they're more like suicide bombers this time around, where they honestly, truly believe that they are being patriotic and that I am like the devil.
No, you're kind of the devil. So stupid language, just silly, unnecessarily so comparison. Suicide bomb, really? Suicide bombers? Now, I do certainly believe that there are people who get aggressive unnecessarily, and I think they think they're doing it for the right reasons, but to me, it doesn't matter. It's still wrong. But I'm not going to pretend that I'm shedding a tear for Stormy Daniels or anyone on the left. Not anymore. I might still think the behavior is wrong, and I'll still call it out, but I'm not as sympathetic as I was before, not after Maxine Waters, the California congresswoman, said this.
And if you see anybody from that cabinet in a restaurant, in a department store, at a gasoline station, you get out and you create a crowd. And you push back on them. Uh-huh. And you tell them they're not welcome.
So I'm sure she thought what she was doing there was patriotic because, you know, they see Donald Trump as a fascist, as a dictator, as a threat to democracy and all the other bumper sticker talking points. But when you decided, Maxine Waters, to do that, and when all the Democrats decided to tell their base in the middle of writing that they should be taking to the streets, you no longer get to lecture anybody about how you're being treated by the opposition. Sorry, you lost that. Now I get to, because I've been consistent in calling all of that stuff out. And everybody else who joined me on either side of the aisle who was consistent, yeah, we all get to continue to say what we want to say about this, and we should at least be heard. I don't care what Stormy Daniels has to say. I don't care what Maxine Waters has to say. Sorry, when you embrace this kind of treatment of the opposition, well, you're also the opposition to someone, to the ones you oppose. They view you the exact same way, and they're going to do unto you what you do unto them. So again, y'all brought this on yourself. Doesn't make it right. But maybe the takeaway from all of this is the rhetoric needs to be dialed back just a little bit on both sides, just a little bit. You can go ahead and still be passionate about whatever issue it is we're talking about. You can be critical as you want. If you want, fine. You can even be a little bit mean-spirited. I can't police that. But when you decide to start letting people harass, encouraging people to harass, quite literally create mobs, and when you're doing that, when you're saying that around a time where there's already a whole bunch of riots taking place, what did you expect was going to happen? When it comes to free speech issues and censorship, I usually read a quote, I recite a quote that was told to me back in 2004. And it's imagine the power to censor in the hands of your worst enemy. And it's usually geared towards some liberal group or liberal activist trying to censor some content that they just don't like. And it's usually completely inoffensive content at that. And I say to them, imagine the power to censor in the hands of your worst enemy, meaning you have power right now to censor. Well, that might not always be the case. In fact, we know that won't always be the case. Your enemy, as you perceive them, will have power. Would you be okay with them? Are you okay with them doing to you what you did to them? And presumably you would say, of course, no, you don't want to be victimized. But these people don't think that they'll ever be out of power. They think that they always will have that power. And so they act like it. And that's how Maxine Waters acted. And things are obviously starting to shift. We went over the polls earlier today. They're very clearly shifting in Trump's direction and have been for a very long time now. And these people who previously seemed to be okay with harassing Trump supporters, MAGA supporters with their KKK hats because they were red. Like, that's how they were talking. They were harassing Trump officials, and that was okay. Well, now they realize, oh, no. They might end up doing to us what we did to them. Now, they could save themselves by simply just saying, you know what? I'm sorry. We screwed this up. And then actually act like you're sorry. I'm not going to hold my breath. It's the Jason Rant Show.